Have a great show. Going in 4, 3, 2.
All right. Welcome, everybody. Burrows and Burbs, episode 102, the Sydney show. We're in Sydney, Australia today with Dominic Longcroft. Say hello, Dominic. And hello, everybody. I've got my partner in New York, Roberto Cabrera. But he's not in New York, are you? You are slipping away with one of those.
Playing hooky in the Hamptons, but working all day long.
4-day weekends that you're prone to do.
Yeah. I'm prone to do. Listen to that.
So here we are in Sydney, Australia. For the first time, we are way, way, way out of our comfort zone. I mean, we've done Marbella in Spain and we've done Norway, but this is a whole nother level of international luxury market exploration. And so I'm very excited, but I am definitely in uncharted territory. Before we begin, I want to thank our sponsor, Grace Farms. Dominic, let me tell you, lean in. I want to tell you about gracefarms.org. If you come to New Canaan, Connecticut, you will see the most incredible modern architecture. It's called the River Building at Grace Farms. But what we're interested in here is not the fantastic architecture or their commitment to ecology and the environment or art. What we're interested in is their commitment to the sustainable building trades. And they have Design for Freedom. They have a logo and a program, and they are working very hard in the Design for Freedom space to make, to get rid of unfair labor practices in the building trade industry. So for people who want to learn more about that, you can either come to New Canaan, Connecticut, visit their campus, have tea with Frank in the tea house, and learn about Design for Freedom, or you can go to their website, designforfreedom.org. Okay, Dominic? So
okay.
Gotten that out of the way.
Yeah.
Now, it's not so improbable. Let me begin with your introduction. It is not so improbable that you might come visit Grace Farms here in Connecticut because you do split your time between New York and Sydney. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. I do. Two reasons why I come to New York. One is I have my eldest daughter who lives in the city and is doing a master's and then intends on staying there. And secondly, I am still a broker at a real estate firm in New York City.
He's covering up the fact that he comes to visit me in New York.
That's right. That's my third reason.
And that's how you two met, right? That's how you came to be on the show, is that you worked on a deal with Roberto not too long ago in Chelsea. And he spoke so highly of you that he said, we've got to get Dominic on the show. Tell me about how that deal went and who won.
Let me tell you something. Let me explain. He represented a seller at the Chelsea Mercantile Building, and I had a very dear client, and it was a very specific, you know, it was the negotiation, and she was a very precise person, et cetera, and we went through this negotiation, and Dominic was impeccable in the product in transacting the deal with me. It was really an amazing thing that we, every single aspect that we had, it was such a professional, and we worked together to make the deal happen because it wasn't easy. And we've maintained a professional relationship ever since. And I consider him a dear friend. And I'm so thrilled that he's succeeding so well in Sydney. It's amazing. So welcome here.
Thank you, Roberto. That's very kind. I do remember that deal was incredibly quick to start, because I think you spoke to me and I listed the property. And I think we had a deal in place on the money side anyway, within 3 days. Which was incredible. And this property had languished on the market for quite a long time. And I remember because I met the sellers when I was in Aspen, and I met them at the firm that I was working with there. I was doing a presentation, and one of the brokers came up to me and said, I've got these sellers and they really want to move to Aspen, but they can't sell their property in Manhattan. Can you help? And I said, sure. So I sat down with them and I did all the comps. And I think I almost knocked them off their chairs when I told them what the value of their property was. But they were very gracious and they really wanted to sell. So they took my advice and I went back to New York, and then we spoke to each other. And within 3 days, we had a deal together. So they were super happy. And I remember that, you know, we had a we had a very, very good rapport and really helped our clients get that deal over the table.
Yeah.
That is a good segue. I'm going to share a screen for just a moment. I found this video on YouTube of you.
I've done a few of those.
Not that long ago. And it was really helpful to understand because you, in this video, for only 3 minutes, and I recommend people just Google your name in YouTube and you'll find the video. But it's a very good explanation of the difference between the Australian luxury market and the business in New York and the business in Australia. Could you summarize that for us? Because you talk about KPIs, the emphasis on KPIs in that video, and how that's changed the approach to the business.
Yes. So there's the fundamental difference between, there's two fundamental differences. One is the average age of a real estate broker in Sydney is around about 30 years old. Okay. So people generally come into this profession after they finish school and they essentially decide that that's the career they want to go into. The New South Wales government almost 4 years ago took a decision to no longer allow real estate firms to hire new brokers who had never transacted before without giving them what I would call a drawdown, which means essentially the firm has to give them money before they actually do a deal on the premise that they're going to do a deal. So they assign them with a senior agent and essentially they get approximately about $5,000 Australian a month, which equates out to about $3,000 US a month. And that enables the broker to live. They can pay their rent, they can buy their groceries, and they essentially can survive. Before that, there were many, many of these kids who were coming into the profession at around 24, 25, who were going bankrupt because they couldn't get a deal off the ground. They were going into debt, and it was becoming a real issue. So that's the first main difference, is that it's a much younger business than it is in New York. As we know, in New York, most people are coming in as a third or a second or a third career. They have a long career. And the average age, I remember doing the research a few years ago, is around 60 years old. So it's a very different proposition when you're meeting a real estate broker in New York or you're meeting a real estate. That's right, exactly. I've got the same. Don't worry. Look, there it is. And Roberto, a little bit of a quiff. Exactly. So that's the fundamental difference that I found when I came to Sydney. The other difference is the way that property is transacted in Australia as a whole, and also in New Zealand, is that properties under $5 million are essentially transacted through the auction process. Okay, it's been now the main way to sell your property, the mainstream, system of the process of selling a property in Australia is through the auction process, and it's a 6 weeks campaign. So essentially, you find your broker, you agree your listing agreement, a contract is written up, and which is then advertised out to the potential people who come to the property. Unlike New York, where the contract is done after agreement between the buyer and the seller. In Sydney and the rest of Australia, the contract is drawn up immediately at the time of the sign of the listing agreement. This is because the contract has to be presented at every open house and every private showing at the property, so that the prospective buyer can take that contract, have it sent to him digitally, and already send it to his attorney before he even makes an offer. So it's a different way of doing it. And the reason is for that, because most of the properties go through auction, you need to remove all the contingencies before the property goes to auction. And so following on from that, the property would go onto the market. There would be most likely, in most cases, two open houses a week, which would last half an hour each. That process would go on for a month. So from start to of signing of agreements to actually going to the auction process is 1 month. Then what happens is an independent auctioneer is invited to come and auction the property, usually because most properties in Sydney are in suburbia. So, you know, half acre lots with the property on the front yard, backyard, and the people who are interested to purchase the property would assemble on the front yard. Probably a good smattering of neighbors would also be there too, because it's in their interest to see what that property goes for. They can immediately then have a value on their property as well, if it's similar. And so therefore, someone's calling me. So after that process happens, the auctioneer comes onto the front and the auction starts. The auctioneer essentially has only really been to the property on the morning of the auction. Auctions normally take place on Saturday mornings, sometimes Sundays, and the auction then commences. So let's say after half an hour, the buyer has been successful, and they will walk into the house with the auctioneer and the listing agent, where the owners will be sitting in the front room waiting for their buyer to arrive. The buyer will arrive, the contracts will be signed, the deposit will be wired, and then 2 weeks after that, the home will be transferred to the buyer. So it's a 6 weeks process.
It sounds like the dating game. It literally sounds like the dating game where you have these guys outside and then come meet your seller.
That's right. And they have TV shows. They have TV shows about this regularly on TV. There's one's called The Block. It's become mainstream. Then the person who devised this way back 28 years ago or so is a chap called John McGrath. Now, John McGrath is a friend of mine. He's an absolutely fantastic broker. He started in his early 20s and started a real estate company called McGrath. And if you look up McGrath, it is now the third largest real estate business in Australia. And he is the person that pioneered the auction process, took it out of that sort of, which in the rest of the world is kind of a dirty word, if you like. It's normally associated with foreclosures. And so therefore, you know, it was the same in Australia probably 30 years ago, but he changed that process to bring that process to people to say, it's not. When you have a number of people who are interested in a property and there needs to be a finite decision on timing, it is the best option to go for both the seller and the
property. Very efficient. Yeah. I love the very idea efficient. That there is a beginning and an end, yes, and an that end. It's predefined, right. And the contingencies are pulled out, and that I can give some assurance to my seller when it'll sell, and that it'll be given a fair shake in the market, and the market will speak. What are some of the problems? Maybe they don't always sell.
The problem is that you need to have a buoyant market in which that to function really well. So when you get a downturn in the market, which we've been having with the problems with interest rates over the last year, you tend to have very low clearance rates. So a high clearance rate will be around 80, 85% on a weekend, which means that 85% of those properties that went to auction had a successful auction and there was a transaction. In the times where you get the sort of the bear markets, if you like, you tend to get around a 50% clearance rate, which essentially means that 50% of those properties, they did not have a successful auction. Now, the issue
is...
Can
the seller create a minimum price?
Yes, they can put a reserve in. Absolutely, they can. Sometimes they don't, sometimes they do. Mainly, the reserves are attributed to financing. So if you have a problem, if you have a property which is 50% finance or 60% finance, you're going to have a number that you know you have to reach above that in order for the property to sell, because obviously you cannot have a situation where the seller is still going to owe money to the bank.
Why does this not reduce the role of the broker to really a commodity? where
John, you're absolutely right. It's almost like a concierge person, right? You're actually a facilitator because you're not actually brokering anything. All you're doing is providing a process. Now, this is one of the issues that I had being a real estate broker, starting my business in Switzerland for 15 years, where I ran a large real estate company in the town of Gstaad, which is a ski resort similar to Aspen in the Swiss Alps. And I was, you know, that's how I cut my teeth in 2000. I was a broker, I built a business, and that's how I knew how to sell real estate in the traditional way that we would do it in New York, what's called here private treaty, which essentially is that you go to market, you have a six-month contract, and you have multiple people visiting the property, open houses or private viewings. And essentially, you get a deal together within that period of time. So coming to Australia, it was a very different way of operating. And my skill set is not really needed in this sort of under $5 million price tag, if you like. Now, above $10 million, which is about $7 million US, absolutely, you need to have people who are, you know, who are used to the process of broking or selling between two different parties. You have to have that skill set because you're not able to really do an auction. Now, auctions in COVID started to escalate. There was an auction that happened with a property in a very, very smart area on the Sydney Harbour. This house sold for $25 million. It started the auction at 12 because there was such a huge demand for this property. And because of COVID, they thought the best way to operate this, obviously, there was partially online. Some people who were able to get to the property got to the property, but it was a kind of quasi online and real time, you know, on physical on the premises. And because there were so many interested buyers, I think from memory, there were 12 registered buyers, that doubled its price. Now, that is very unusual. But at that time, it was a record breaker. They'd never seen that before. So we've started to see the auction process slowly creep above the 5 million level now since COVID. But essentially, it's not as mainstream above 5 million as it is under 5 million. I mean, any real estate broker or real estate agent, as they're labeled here, will really give the seller no other option other than auctioning their property.
So you're saying about 80% of the deals are done by auction.
80% of the clearance rate. So if you have on any Saturday in New South Wales, which is where Sydney is, you've probably got somewhere between 2,000 to 4,000 properties which are being auctioned. And so the clearance rate of 80% comes from the amount of auctions which are successful. Okay.
So as a seller, I want to sell my property.
Yes.
You're going to advise me probably, say, so you're going to do this by auction, but what are my other options?
And so your other options, you have two other options. One is private treaty, which is how we do it in New York, right? And the other one is expressions of interest, which is essentially you get buyers going to the property. There is a finite date when they accept bids, which are sealed. Okay, so the same process happens. The buyer will go to the property. They'll view it. They'll see it. They'll take the contract away with them. They'll send it to their attorney. And then they will decide what they feel is the right price to offer for that property. Now, don't forget that in every situation here, there is a guide price. And the guide price is basically a 10% above is around about, let's say the property has a guide price of the owner wants to get $1 million for their property. The guide price would be then $900 to $1.1 million. So that would be the guide, if you like, where you go into. That is not shown on the internet. So if you go and look for a property which you want to buy on the MLS here, which is run by, which is a news court product called realestate.com.au, which is the number one portal, a bit like Perchwell or Street Easy, where you can go online and you can see all the listings at any one time. Very, very seldom do they have the guide price. They will not advertise the price on the listings. So it forces the buyer to contact the agent to find out how much, what the guide price is. So once the guide price is understood and that person has seen the property, they will do a sealed bid before the end date for the expressions of interest. And those will be presented to the seller at on a finite date, usually in the listing agent's office, where let's say there might be five or three, depending on how interested parties are on the property. And then that the owner would open up those sealed bids and then decide which one he was going to accept. Sometimes if it's a little bit, it's a lesser amount than the seller would like, there is potential there for negotiation. So essentially, they would take the highest bid or the best and final, if you like, and then they would go back to that attorney and discuss that they could accept that, but they would maybe have to get to a number which was slightly increased. And that's essentially how the expressions of interest system works. So there are three main ways to sell your property here.
So I have so many questions. One is, do you have much of an off-market kind of market where private sales, you know, just word of mouth?
Yes, so we do. So my first job, if you like, in Sydney when I arrived in 2020 is I contacted a guy called Ken Jacobs. Now, Ken Jacobs is a bit of a legend over here. He's been in the market for over 50 years. He sold more property than any agent in Australia. And he's hit all the big numbers. He's one of only two people who have sold properties over $100 million on the Sydney Harbour, and actually done several of those. So I contacted Ken completely out of the blue, and we got on very well. And I hung my license at Christie's when I first started here. Now, Ken does most of his deals offline, off market. You don't even know the properties that he's doing because essentially he has got, a number of the high worths, including high net worths, including the Murdoch family, who will decide they want to offload a property. They don't really want anyone to know about it, but he's on the other side going to know another high net worth individual who would like to buy that property, and the deal is done offline. So there are a number of deals which you don't even get to hear about. And then suddenly maybe 2 or 3 weeks later, you hear about it in the press because a journalist has found out about it. And there's usually a no comment. So yes, there are. But okay. in the level under $5 million, no. Most properties go through this process because it really has become mainstream. And it really works for both buyer and seller, especially if you've got a family who need to move into a new property. And there is a timing issue. This is the best way to achieve that, especially in a market which is a buoyant market. We can talk about the market conditions now, but maybe you want to
in a minute. I still have a couple of questions. We've been talking a lot about seller representation. What about buyer representation? How do the commissions work?
So an agent here essentially decides whether they're going to become a listing agent or a buyer's agent. Okay. In fact, the regulatory body in New South Wales Fair Trading allows a broker, a real estate agent, to do both. But the only thing you can't do is both at the same property. Now, there is no dual agency here, so you can't do that. So you can't represent both parties. But what you can do is you can be a seller's, a buyer's agent on one property and a listing agent on another. Most people in 95% of the properties decide they're going to be one or the other. So there is a very big buyer's agency companies. So they're only buyer's agents. That's all they do. They don't have any listing agents in the company. So they might have 20 real estate agents working in a firm, but they're all buyer's agents. And then conversely, with companies like I mentioned McGrath, all of their people are listing agents. So they've really separated both of those parts, which in my opinion, having worked on both, is a mistake. And my agency, Kincaid, allows my agents to do both and to advertise themselves both as listing agents and buyer's agents. purely because I know that in most cases, when people are coming into the business, actually being a buyer's agent is really how you really cut your teeth, because you've got people, friends and family want to buy something and you represent them. And only after the fact that you get a bit of a reputation, do you get the confidence to list the property. And that's not dissimilar to how it works here. The difference is here is if you're getting into the business, you generally join a team. And if you're the youngest broker in the house, you are essentially, and I bring myself back, and I think maybe that podcast, that post there that John saw, I was mentioning the fact that when I started in real estate, my first job out of university was selling life insurance. And there is a big similarity for the young brokers in the way that they try to procure, the way that they try to procure clients, in the same way that I used to in the 1980s, try and get clients to buy life insurance policies off me. Essentially, it's cold calling, a heavy amount of cold calling. Those agents are required to do 200 phone calls a day and mark down on a sheet that they do. They then have to keep a score sheet, if you like. And they are essentially, that's what they do for 8 to 9 hours a day. Now, that's not the way that I have started my career in selling real estate. I always started with my network, and then I grew my network and I did it organically. So it's a different way of doing it. But I suppose for the companies that operate out of here, there is no other real choice for them to do, because they have to be able to make those real estate agents come into the market, earn their $5,000 Australian a month, because they can't get it back. So once it's sent to that new recruit, he doesn't have to pay it back. So what do the management do? They put the person to work, and that's essentially what they do. So they are they're in the engine room of the team to bring those leads. And once those leads come out, generally that agent who may be 23, 25 years old will not get the chance to actually develop that lead. That will go to a senior broker. So it's a different way of doing it here. Yeah.
And what's the commission rate of like selling?
So the commission rate is essentially, because it's not both sides. So not like in Europe, we get 6% or 5% and we split it 50-50. That's not the case here. So there's only one listing. There's only one price. And that's usually somewhere between 2% and 1.5%. Sometimes some agents, you know, some of the really hungry agents will reduce that down to 1%. But it's very difficult to make money on that when you're dealing with something $500,000 by the time that you've.
Explain that a little bit better. You said it's not split. That means it's 2% each side still?
No, there's no each side. So if you've got a listing agent and they're essentially bringing that property to market via auction, there is no reason to have a buyer's agent. Now, somebody who is going to maybe go at auction to go through that process, a buyer, he may instruct a buyer's agent to assist him through the process, especially maybe if he's new to the country, especially maybe if he feels that he could get a better price by having a better buyer's agent. The buyer's agent would have to be paid directly by the buyer. And so therefore, that generally is somewhere between 2% to 3% of the selling price, but that is solely paid for by the buyer. So
would a buyer do that if realtor.com.au is available? Correct. And exactly. I can browse the properties.
And that's why they don't. So they don't, most people don't use it. Buyer's agents really come into their own with people who are new to the process of buying real estate in Sydney or another city around New South Wales or even around Australia. They come into their own because, like we do in New York City, we have a great raft of information to be able to pass on to our buyers to guide them through the process. And that's where they come into their element, but not really in an auction process. Because if you've got somebody who's lived in Sydney all their life, they've maybe sold 2 or 3 properties, they maybe bought 2 or 3 properties, they're not going to need a buyer's agent because they know the process.
There's entire firms that specialize in
that's right, there are. But most of those firms will be dealing in property over $5 million. So they'll be in the sphere, which is not at auction. So when you're going to the expressions of interest or private treaty, it may be a good idea to bring in a buyer's agent, because essentially that 2-3% you're going to have to pay to them, you're probably going to save in their negotiation skills on purchasing the property for you.
Is this countrywide? Is this in Adelaide? Is this in Perth? Is this in Melbourne?
Everywhere. This is everywhere in Australia, everywhere in New Zealand, and also, interestingly, in South Africa.
Wow.
Those are the three principal areas of where auction is mainstream in the property space.
I've pulled up the map of Australia on the screen. Where are you and what markets are we talking about?
So I sit in where you see New South Wales, which is the orange state. You'll see there halfway down the coast is Sydney. And so that's where I live there. Exactly. Yeah. The capital of Australia is Canberra, which if you look there underneath the next red one, exactly, it has its own territory, which is called ACT, which is the Australian Capital Territory. Okay. Which is Canberra was built. Now, I'm not sure how many years ago, but I think let's say around 100 years ago, maybe less, which was a purpose-built city to hold the seat of government. Because essentially before then, Sydney and Melbourne were the biggest capitals, and they could not make up their mind which one of them would be the capital city. So they agreed to build a new city almost halfway between them, which was called Canberra. And then...
Where's the luxury market? Is there a luxury market in Canberra?
Oh, yes. Well, yeah, no, not really. I wouldn't say there's a luxury market in Canberra. I've been to Canberra 2 or 3 times. My wife is in there every week for her work. But it's not essentially, it's predominantly, diplomats who go there. So every country in the world has got an embassy in there. Well, the majority of them. And so therefore there is a team of Americans and Canadians and Brits who would all work in the embassy there, and they would all also need real estate. But I don't think there are, top end luxury like you would see in Sydney or Melbourne. But that's not to say they don't have very large ranches outside Canberra. It's very fertile country. In fact, I know a family who have a very, very large ranch out there. So there is a lot of ranches, but in the city itself, not so many luxury properties.
I'm interested in the Gold Coast. Anybody who has called
absolutely
Gold that's Coast a bit, must have a good marketing like, department.
That's a bit like Cancun. That's where all the casinos are. That's where all the big high rises on the beach are. So a little bit like Cancun or Miami. That's a bit like South Beach, maybe. That's the kind of vibe that's going on there.
Really?
A lot of sunshine all year round. A lot of luxury, big condos on the beach, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Okay. And Brisbane and Melbourne, what about these other cities?
The way I like to compare them is Melbourne is a bit like New York. And Sydney's a bit like LA, right? So Sydney is much more of a beach culture. The weather's better all year round. I mean, we get to tops of 21, 22 degrees in the middle of our winter. So that in Fahrenheit's in the 70s, right? And then our summers in Sydney go up to around about in the 80s, in the 90s sometimes. And, it doesn't really get much below 70 degrees. However, in Melbourne, it's got a much more of a wetter climate. So there's a bit more rain. It's a bit cooler. And it's a very sophisticated city. I like Melbourne very much myself. It's kind of a cafe society, if you like. It's a little bit more academic, if you like. A little bit more if a big show is going to come, which has got an academic edge to it, it'll go to Melbourne. But if you want Taylor Swift's coming to Sydney.
That's hilarious. So let's switch a little bit. We talk regionally, like you're in a different quarter of the entire globe than we are. But
yes,
I hear so many people are coming there, especially if it was particularly from Asia and Vietnam and things like that. There's a lot of money coming from there into.
Yes.
But where else is the money coming from, and why are people coming?
Well, China, for instance, has had a massive uptick in people emigrating from China. And I think that's probably quite obvious why. They like the rule of law. The rule of law is basically derived from the United Kingdom. You know, the country has only been a country for 120 years. They federated in 1902. So essentially before there, it was ruled by Great Britain. And so it's got a very good law system here. It's a fair country. It's a safe country. It's a very, you know, it is, like all countries, there are issues, of course. But if you're comparing it to China, and you're somebody who's made good money, there's a very good, you know, there's probably a very good reason that you'd like to be able to move here to educate your children, and obviously, you know, to give them a better way of life, if you like. So with China, it's very much that's been a big draw for them to come here.
Would the choice be like go to Western US or go to Australia, and Australia is a much better value? Or
yes, I think also, you know, there is somewhat at the moment, sadly, and I do say this sadly, I think there's a little bit of a stigma with the US at the moment. I think it can be viewed as a place when we're looking from outside, you know, guns is an issue, and it's what we hear a lot about. And, you know, from outside, there is it's expensive. The dollar is super strong at the moment, making it very difficult to buy something of any meaningful size. You know, and also emigration, it can be very difficult. Australia does have a, you know, if you are a professional person, the door is open to come to Australia. It really is. They want to have more professional people. You know, the landmass of Australia is the same as the United States. Okay. And in the United States, I think the population is what? 300 million people? Something
close
like that?
Close to 400, I think 350.
Okay. Yeah, 350. 25 million people live in Australia. So it's a tenth of the size, right? Most people live on the coast, okay? There are a few people who live in the middle, but very few. And so the opportunity here is still pretty good. Raw materials, you know, all those iron ore, coal is fizzling out, but all those kind of, you know, fossil fuels that we still need, we don't want to have, but we still need, it keeps the engine running for Australia. So Australia, essentially, you know, in COVID, billions and billions of dollars keeping the show on the road, right? They closed the borders for 18 months, no foreign investment coming in, you know, and nobody could get inside or out. And within 3 years, they've managed to balance the budget again. You know, it doesn't take very long for them to do it because taxation is high here. It starts at 50% over $180,000. So, you know, it doesn't take much for the country to refill their coffers again to start again. So they're always looking for more professionals to come in, families to come in. And they have a rule, and I think it's the same in the US, that, you know, if a professional couple come in with their kids and they emigrate, then the rest of the family can follow suit after a period of time. So that's very, you know, interesting, for instance, for a Chinese family or a Vietnamese family or a Korean family who generally have a lot of family members. And so they all generally end up coming here over a period of time.
How are you attracting the, like, one of the things in New York and Connecticut and all those places, there's a flight because of the taxation. They're going to Palm Beach. They're going to Texas, you know.
Yeah.
You have such a high taxation rate, though. What's the draw?
Well, my wife, I mean, she has a fantastic job and she pays a huge amount of tax, but it's what you pay for your ability to live here. And, you know, it is a great lifestyle. I mean, you know, it really is. It's a very different lifestyle. And so there's a big draw for that. And if you have to pay for that, that's just the price of doing business. If you want to do that, there are no options of, you know, being offshore or going to Delaware. There are no options like that. It just doesn't exist. You know, you know, and you know, a lot of Australians decide that, you know, they want to go and make their fortunes in the US and they get a great job in New York on Wall Street or whatever. And they spend maybe 20 to 30 years of their life abroad. They make a phenomenal amount of money. And yes, they probably pay a lot less tax. But you know what's interesting? They all come back and then they buy the forever home and then they buy the $25 million home. And then they, you know, they move back in their late 50s or 60s and spend the rest of their life in Australia. So there are the people who don't want to pay that tax and feel very strongly about it and, you know, maybe are ready to leave Australia for whatever reason. And they do that. But there is a huge significant amount of people, you know, my wife's family, who all of them have good jobs and all of them pay their tax. And that's just how it is. It's just not. It's grumbled about a little bit, but it's not like the same in the US where, as you said, you know, people will move from from New York down to Florida and set themselves up or go to Texas or, you know, for those great, you know, company incentives. It just doesn't seem to happen here. And it doesn't make a difference which state you go to. It really doesn't. Your federal tax and your state tax is pretty much the same. And as well as your what they call GST here, which is, the tax added that you would have if you go to a restaurant or whatever, or you're buying a product. Yeah.
I think, so I want to continue on what Roberto was thinking, because I was about to say the same thing. I'm holding up a copy of the Knight Frank Wealth Report.
Yes.
And in it, they talk a good deal about Australia. And so I pulled up on the screen some of their predictions. And I'll just call your attention to the ultra high net worth.
Yes.
Crowd in 2022, and Australia's got 17,000 very wealthy people in 2022. Correct. But yes. In 5 years, and you're in third place behind China and Japan among Asian countries, but you'll be down in seventh place and you'll only gain a few 24,000 in the next 5 years. And I think it's what Roberto is getting to, which is while your wife has a good job and to have that job, she has to be in Australia to have that job.
Correct. But
the ultra high net worth individuals, when choosing where to invest, I think would be and live would be discouraged if they were making $100 million, giving half of that away in taxes.
You're absolutely right. And that is exactly that. If you have to work in Australia, you have no choice but to pay the tax. That's why I said that a lot of educated Australians who finish high school, maybe go to university in the US, they just don't tend to come back. They get a great job, and especially now with the new arrangement of AUKUS between Australia and the US and the UK, we've seen a lot of, you know, visa issues which are easing up between those countries now. So it becomes easier. It's always been pretty easy, and as an Australian, to work in the US. That happened at the first Gulf War when they got an allocation of visas which were made available to Australians and New Zealanders. And essentially, I think that quota is somewhere around about 70,000 per year that, you know, can be taken up. And the only requirement is that you work in the same field that you had your university degree. So if you're an attorney and you become an attorney in the University of Sydney and you want to become an attorney in New York City, you can move, no problem. You will be able to move, you'll get the visa, and you'll have to take the different exams that, you know, the New York bar require you to do, but essentially then you're good to go. So there's a very big, strong agreement between the three countries now on that. And so therefore there are a number of Australians who will decide to leave Australia, you know, after they've complete their university education and move to the States or move to the UK to do a different job under a different taxation system. But for those people that, you know, remain in Australia, they'll pay that. For instance, you know, one of the biggest trades here is what we call in Australia, they're called tradies. So they're essentially people in the trade who come to fix your house, do the plumbing, do the electric. And a lot of them are one-man bands with their pickup trucks, which they call utes here. And they've got their entire operation on the back, on the flatbed. And they'll go to the house and they'll fix your things, but they will not be discounting. They will not be paying for cash. they'll be charging you about 100 US an hour for the jobs that they do. So there is no, you know, how's the best way to say this? There are no illegal people here. This doesn't exist. So you don't have a situation like I had in New York City and I needed to get something done into my apartment. There would be someone down the road who knew somebody else who would do it for cash and I could give them $50 and they would do it. That doesn't exist here. So you've got a really vibrant market of people who are putting everything through the channels that they should be doing. And so they're paying their tax, but they are living very good lives. I mean, I had a listing. I'll give you an example. I had a listing in Sydney a couple of years ago. Actually, I had two listings. One was $8 million and one was $12 million. And the $8 million listing, I would have people coming to the show, coming to the open house, who were in their work boots, they were in their overalls, they had the ute outside. And I was like, and I thought to myself, you know, I didn't want to be judgmental, but I thought to myself, is this person really going to be able to buy this house? And when they would show me, you know, before they made their offers or their financials, I was flabbergasted. These people make a hell of a lot of money and they can afford to buy a $5 or $6 million house. So
let's talk. We have 10 minutes or so left. Let's talk about that luxury market and how it's changed since COVID. Australia took a rather severe policy.
Draconian.
Close the borders. Close the borders right. During COVID.
They did.
And what did that do? So let's begin with COVID. What did that do to your luxury market? How was it before the closing of the borders? And did that impact it?
Yes, it did. Because before in 2019, the actual real estate market in Australia was actually going through a bit of a tough time. And it was pretty lackluster across the board. COVID came beginning of 2000. It was pretty severe. They shut down the borders in March of 2020. But by the end of that year, and I would say going into September, October, we started to see a massive uptick in the market. And that was across the board, whether it was under $5 million or in the luxury space. It was pretty intense because most people, all the high net worths that are here, and there are a number of them, they started to focus their energies on buying property in Australia. And so therefore it was a captive audience. They literally, those people who may have thought about buying that apartment in New York or buying it in LA or London, they were not buying it there because they couldn't get there. And don't forget at the time, we didn't know how long this was gonna last. This could have lasted 5 years. You know, the pundits out there and the health people were telling us that there was no end in sight. And so essentially people just started to rally around the property market. And we saw the prices go up on average between 35 and 40% increase in the 20 and 21 markets. And so there was a lot of transactions that happened. They had never had such a buoyant market since the records even started. What's happened now after the pandemic is that a combination of the interest rates rise and the end of the pandemic where people are traveling again, we've seen that 40%, 35% lose about 20% of value in the market, okay? But we're still above the pre-pandemic levels. So we're still above 2019, but my prediction is that we're going to see the market get flooded with investment properties in the next year. And the reason is that the mortgage market here is very different than the US. So in the US, you get government-backed mortgages of 20 to 30 years, depending on which one you choose to do. And when you're buying your property, maybe when you're starting out and you're buying your first home, in first major home at the age of 30 in the US, you buy your mortgage for 30 years and it sticks with you till you're 60. And you may change three or four properties in that process, right? And you'll have to pay administration fees, but you'll hold the same mortgage. In Australia, like the UK, if you sell your property, your mortgage goes, okay? It's finished. And so therefore, you have to then start the whole process again. Now, don't forget that a year ago, if I was to buy a mortgage in Australia, it would cost me 2% for probably a 2-year fixed mortgage. Right now, if I go out to the market, it's going to cost me 7, right? And the problem is with that is that's why the market at the moment is incredibly good in Sydney and in other cities, and it's remained very strong. And the reason is because there's no inventory. So people are still needing to buy properties, but it's keeping the property market at an incredibly, even keel.
You didn't say 30-year mortgage. You said what?
2 years. So I said in the US, you get a 20 or 30-year ARM, right? Here, your maximum fixed rate for a mortgage is 2 years. So when you sell your property now, you've had a 2% fixed. You want to buy your new property, it's going to cost you 7%. It's going to cost you 3 times the amount of money that your borrowing did a year ago because of the interest rates.
Does everybody have to get a new mortgage every 2 years?
Everybody has to get a new mortgage. Yeah.
There's no longer terms in that?
No.
Why?
Because the banks are guaranteeing it. It's not government backed. I think Roosevelt, after the New Deal, he was the one who introduced Fannie Mae, right? After the New Deal in the 1930s. Yeah. So he gave that to the people to say, I'm going to give you that assurance for 20 to 30 years, fixed term, so you can buy your property and live in it for the duration of your working life. That never happened anywhere else in the world. Australia looked at it. New Zealand looked at it. The UK looked at it, but they never ratified it. So the banks are the people that take it. They can't afford to basically give anything more than that because of the interest rates. And that's been very evident now. Because if a bank was to be able to give that at 2%, riding through with this, and then the interest rates don't come down for 6 or 7 years, got a problem.
So therefore, two minutes. So yeah, let's see if we could sum this up. Because we can keep talking after that, but we got about 2 minutes. So it occurs to me that you had the market got terrific in 20 and 21, up 30%, yep. Then it flattened or it went down? Did it correct down. 10%?
It went down. It
10
went
down. Or 20?
20%. It was, the high was 40 in some suburbs. Sydney had a number of suburbs that were 40%, and it's gone down on average about 20%.
But where is it going? Above. And where
is
it going?
This is what I'm going to say. Is that the majority of those properties that were bought in COVID times were investment properties, right? All on a 2-year fixed. The problem is now is that those investment properties are going to have to get new mortgages, and they've got tenants in them, but the tenants are not going to be paying another, 10%, 20%, 30% on their rentals, because that's not going to be achievable. So what does the owner do of the property who owns that $1 million or $2 million property, who's going to go from 2% to 7% borrowing by the end of this year? They're going to have to put the property on the market and sell it. So we're going to see
a big amount of rents.
Not that much. I don't think they can put the rents up that much. So they cannot be in a situation where they're losing money. Okay, so they'll put them on the market. So we're going to see an increase of inventory. And then you know what happens with that?
We're going to see a crisis.
We could be seeing a crisis. You're absolutely right.
Which is a good buying opportunity for wealthy people.
Which is a great buying opportunity for wealthy. All cash. Absolutely. Fantastic opportunity.
Guys, we're going to have to do a part 2 on this.
All right.
Because we have not talked about the geographical area of Sydney, what's Jervis Bay, et cetera. We haven't gotten there.
Yes.
I want to thank
Roberto for putting this together. I would like to thank Dominic Longcroft. This has been very illuminating. Stay tuned for part 2 on The Sydney Show. Thank you.
Amazing.
Thank you.
All right.
Can we hang?
That's it for
All Voice clear. America. Great show, guys.
We can continue talking.
John, because I noticed you recorded late, can we just do the beginning?
I can splice in the beginning.
Thank you, fellas. Okay. Great show.
Thanks. I don't want to talk more unless we're going to record it. We got to do a part 2. We got to do the whole, what's around the harbor? Why is that? What these suburbs, what do people do? Do they commute? Do they this? Do they that? What are the taxes when you buy? We haven't gotten any of that.
Okay.
We do have to do a part two.
All right, we'll do a part two.
Dominic, amazing amount of information.
Thank you. Well, I'm happy to educate. I've been here almost 4 years now, so it's very interesting. I find it fascinating. It is such a different market than what I was used to in New York. It really is. But it's also great to be able to, you know, still be tuned into New York and then to be able to help my agents here to be able to understand how to build their markets in a different way.
I mean, every few minutes you brought up a new piece of information that is really mind-blowing for the typical American agent who's watching this show. The fact that you have the emphasis on auction, the fact that you treat buyer agents and seller agents so differently, the fact that you have a guaranteed draw for, and therefore 23-year-olds, 25-year-olds enter the business. And some of that appealed to me and it sounds very attractive. This is a way we could encourage more young participation in the business in America. But then I could begin to see some of the challenges with that what happens in order to pay that bill.
One of the main problems is the transactional side to it. Now, obviously, you know, being real estate brokers as we all are, there is the transaction that you want to do, and we're not doing this for free. But the problem that I have seen with the younger generation coming in, they are so hungry and so aggressive that they tend to hound sellers in a way that I've never seen before. Some sellers have spoken to me saying they're getting upwards of 10 phone calls a day, trying to convince them to sell their house. And the only reason they are is because on that block where they live, one house is decided to sell, and they target every single house within 20 houses of that particular house that's gone on the market, convincing them to sell. And they almost literally have to disconnect their phones. It's really intense. And so therefore, that's something which is the sort of the dark side, if you like, of that problem, is that the companies are making these young agents literally like working in a sweatshop. And that's something that I really have difficulty with. It especially becomes very difficult for women who are in those businesses, and that's how they're operating. And then they decide to get married, they decide to have children. And it's really not in the interest of the company to be able to keep people on like that anymore, because they don't have 100% of their time that they can dedicate to their real estate business. They've got a child to bring up, whatever. So I've had a number of women come to me, and I've helped probably 10, 15 of them to transition into different businesses and help them to sort of look at it in a different way, because it's really challenging. They just can't operate in that. And also, it's quite a male-dominated market, which is very different than the US, as you know. I would say it's probably, there are almost maybe now more women brokers than there are the men. Whereas here, it's still probably only 10% of the market. And so it's very differently operated. And so I think there are some major positives, but there are also some negatives which come along with that.
Although you credit Roosevelt and the New Deal and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac for providing that stability in the market, I would say that a key component is the mortgage-backed security. And the fact that we sell these mortgages, we bundle these mortgages, and we sell them into the bond market. And two things happen. The guys down on Wall Street sell them to people on a pension, and therefore they know they're going to get a 7% return for the next 10 years, 20 years. So they buy that mortgage. And Fannie Mae and Freddie have set the standard by which those mortgages have to meet a certain quality. Otherwise, they become, you know, junk mortgages. So if they're of a certain quality, therefore, you know, that's why we had a crisis in 2008, because we were no longer meeting the standard. Yeah. But when the financial system is working, that 30-year mortgage translates into many 10-year and 20-year bonds.
Yes.
I don't understand why Australian mortgages couldn't be issued longer term, bundled and sold as into the bond market?
It's a good question, and I don't have the answer for you, John, because I'm not able to understand the intricacies of that. But I do know that it's, you know, at the moment, the people, as usual, who are really winning on this is the banks. I mean, it is phenomenal the profits that they're recording at the moment in the last year. And there's no downside for them, really, because after 2 years, I mean, I think maybe you can get a 3-year. I know this because I did a lot of research into this. My wife has an investment apartment. And so therefore, I've been, you know, talking to a number of banks on this. And it seems to me, you know, most of the banks only offer, you know, 2-year fixed. And, you know, my wife is coming off her 2-year fixed in the next year. And we will have to seriously look at it, and we'll have to look at whether it is better to actually pay off the mortgage or whether it's better to stay in the mortgage. And so, you know, it is a real challenge. And when you've got an investment property, which you've bought probably at 80% that you on a mortgage, I don't see how you can hang on to it if you're suddenly your fixed rate goes from 2% to 7%. It's just not feasible to do that unless you've had such an incredible 2 years that you've made enough money to pay off the entire mortgage and do that. Now, in some cases, maybe that's the case, or at least a 50% reduction that they'll do in the mortgage.
In all fairness, that Australia has never experienced a run up in interest prices that we have experienced in the last 2 years. So they've never really been tested to this extent.
Correct. But the interest rates are the same here as they are in the US. I mean, they basically, it's almost a mirror image of every single time the Fed would put up theirs. So did the central bank here, the same thing. And we're almost, I think, at about the same level. I think
we seem to have more optionality of how to yes. maneuver than you do.
Correct. So you have fluidity in the property market. So if somebody wants to sell their house that's on a 20-year mortgage, you know, at the end of it, they still can do that because the mortgage is unaffected, right? The difference is here is it's a huge deal for someone to sell their house. So who has been benefiting? Those tradies I was talking about. They are building extensions. They're going up. They're going the side. They're making a basement. All the construction around the place is absolutely at the all-time high because people are taking small mortgages, small loans in order to facilitate those. So they're taking $100,000 or $200,000, maybe $300,000 to do that bit, but that's nothing compared to the $2 million mortgage that they have, which, you know, at the end of the day is fixed for the moment. But it's very tough. So we're going to see, I think by the end of the year, we're going to start to see a very different market than what we have now. And I think almost certainly there's going to be a lot more inventory in the market.
Mm. It's some of the same volatility that we're seeing in the commercial market in the United States. And it's being led by San Francisco. A lot of stories being written about San Francisco, but yeah. also in New York, where commercial paper is coming yeah. due and can't yeah. be refinanced at the same yeah. rates. And therefore, it's a crisis in the commercial space. What's interesting to me is whether that crisis in your residential space, as a result of not being able to finance long term, whether that changes the inventory picture. Here, people don't want to give up their low interest loans and trade into a 7% loan, so they hold property off the market. It'll be interesting if you do start to see an avalanche of property of inventory as a result of financial policy.
Yeah, I think so. It's going to be a very interesting market. And I just wanted to add one thing, which I was talking to Roberto about, you know, what's happening on the west side of this country. Perth, for instance, has seen no reduction in their after COVID. There's been a huge uptick in property. I'm just going to read something that says the only market affected by the downturn, and not to have been affected by the downturn and the increased values. Perth population is growing, contributing to the heightened demand for housing, pushing up market prices, and people are flocking to the city. Demand for new homes, rental properties has been on the rise, causing a soar. So even though in Sydney, where we started to see these declines, is mainly the reason is that the Sydney and the Melbourne markets obviously are incredibly sought after. And in Perth, it's still a, you know, it is a sought after market, but nowhere near the same as Sydney and Melbourne. And so what we've started to see is that there are a lot of people who are starting to see that as value. They're starting to see that as maybe an option to go and relocate to start a new job to. And, you know, and Perth has been the benefactor of that. So they haven't seen those decreases of those 20% declines that we've seen over in Sydney and Melbourne. And Perth, I mean, I've never been myself. My wife has been there, but it's, you know, beautiful beaches. You see the sunset because you're in the west. And it's a really growing city. Also a very wealthy state. Western Australia is one of the wealthiest states in Australia because of all the mining.
Wow. All right. Yeah. Part two. When can we put part two
on the We're going to find a date soon. But we need to find a date soon because we should kind of pair them up.
Yeah. Thank you, Dominic. Yeah. Thank you, Roberto.
Thank you. Great to see you.
This is great.
Great to see you, friend. Too.
Skipper, take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.